Now that we're going to do the teaching, let me say a word of prayer. Father, I thank you for everyone in this room, and I thank you for the opportunity to record this message for others to hear later. And also, Father, I thank you for your permission to present this teaching. And I pray that only your words will be remembered and go forth and bring forth fruit, and anything that comes of myself will fall by the wayside and will be forgotten. I pray this in Yeshua's name. Amen. This Torah portion is Bamidbar 2022, and I've titled it The Wilderness and the 144,000. So I'll be concentrating mostly on the 144,000, but I will also do some explaining about what else was going on with the Aaronites and the Levites, and that being the Levites being put into service into the tabernacle. But we're now going to compare the first Israelite army with the last Israelite army. We've already learned over the last few months how the Israelites failed at the golden calf and ended up with a substitute priesthood and high priest that failed before and during its ordination, thus needing to be replaced from the inception of the nation called Israel. In fact, we have learned that Yahweh needed to replace that entire first generation in Hebrews 8, 7 to 13. And now we're going to see the difference between Yahweh's two armies. This first one in Bamidbar, Numbers chapters 1 and 2, that was part of that first generation, and the army that will be from the last generation. With that in mind, let me ask a pertinent question. Why is the end times army of Israel, the 144,000, only about 19% the size of the first one? I hope to answer that question. It may not seem all that important, but actually it is a very important question. Numbers 1:1 says, Yahweh spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting on the first day of the second month in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, this census happened 13 months after the Exodus, 1 month after the tabernacle was raised and the line of Aaron was ordained. And this counting, this census, is about 3 weeks after the deaths of Nadab and Abihu. So it seems like we're going over and over this golden calf incident. And we are. The entire books of Exodus and Leviticus cover only a year's time. And in that time was the most important event in Israel's new life as a nation, after having gotten out of Egypt, of course. But now we will begin to move beyond the golden calf incident and into some new problems and new rebellions. These will, however, all have the same spirit as the golden calf rebellion. So now let's go to the census. In Numbers 1 and 2, this census is counting men of battle age, 20 years old and upward, to any age that a man is capable of doing battle. Numbers 1 verse 3 says, from 20 years old and upward, all who are able to go to war in Israel. So how many men are there that can go to war? How many warriors do we have? You know, the commander of every nation needs to know this. And Israel's commander is Yahweh. Not only does he already know how many fighting men there are, he wants Aaron and Moses to know. It's a matter of legalities. This is the establishing of a formal army for Israel. And it is through Aaron and his line that these men will go to battle. They will call them forth to battle. You don't just go to battle. The government calls you to battle. And so you could consider this to be a draft or a conscription. But there will not be a call from Yahweh for another census after this one until at the end of the book of Numbers when Israel is ready to enter the promised land. Because there's going to be some stuff that's going to happen now that will prevent them from being permitted by Yahweh to go into the promised land. However, the reason for this census is to prepare the Israelites to enter the promised land and to have a regimented army to do that. Now, as I said, we're going to see that they refuse to enter, and that will cause them to have to wait for another 39 years so that the rebels can all die off and the children of those people can go in and then take the land. So after the next census, at the end of Numbers, Yahweh will never call for a census of Israel again until the end of days when he marks the men in his army of 144,000. Now, in the interim, David will do a census, but he will also pay a big price for it because it is not up to a man to do this. You know, I couldn't go into the Pentagon and start counting, you know, warriors in the U.S. Army. I'm not authorized to do this. As king, David was not authorized to do that either. Israel's army is commanded by Yahweh only. And of course, the commander of the army in Revelation 7 and 14 is the Lamb. Now, we know who the Lamb is. That's Yeshua, and he is also Yahweh. When David conducted the census in his time, he was usurping Yahweh's place as commander of Israel's army. In the end of days, the census is already prophesied. We already know how many fighting men there will be in Yahweh's army. And fighting age is important. Prophetically, it will tell us something about the 144,000. Numbers 1:16 says, "These are those who were called of the congregation, the princes of the tribes of their fathers. They were the heads of the thousands of Israel." They were called. The 144,000 are called, and they are sealed for their duty. Numbers 1:17, "And Moses and Aaron took these men who were called by name." The individual men in the end of days who will lead each tribe in Revelation 7 and 14 are not called by name. This is because Yeshua will be leading them. There is no need to name the leaders of the 144,000 because there are no leaders of the 144,000. Every man answers directly to Yeshua. Each one is under Yeshua's direct command. Numbers 1:18. "They assemble all the congregation together on the first day of the second month, and they declared their ancestry by their families, by their father's house, according to the number of the names, from 20 years old and upward, one by one." So each tribal head accounted for all the warrior age men, but they had to recount their heritage, who their father was, who their father's father was, and they had to go all the way back through their ancestry, their genealogy, and they had to tell Aaron and Moses who they were, and then that was how they got called and sealed to be warriors in Israel's first army. So the 12 tribes produced 603,550 warriors in Numbers 2:32. But these warriors accounted for only a percentage of the total population. Keep that in mind. The army of Israel is permitted to only have men age 20 and upward. There will be no teenagers, no boys in this army. The men in the army may be very old, however. You know, how can this be? What about their physical fitness? Well, today, in the end of days, there is a theory bandied about in Messianic Jewish and Hebrew roots and Christian circles that only healthy men of what we think of as fighting age in our world today, and those who are well trained in some martial art or they have military experience, will comprise the 144,000. These are not requirements for the army of the 144,000. What then are the requirements for the 144,000? Well, keep listening because I hope to give you that information. Revelation 7, verses 4 through 8. I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed out of every tribe of the children of Israel. Of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000, of the tribe of Reuben 12,000, of the tribe of Gad 12,000, of the tribe of Asher 12,000, of the tribe of Naphtali 12,000, of the tribe of Manasseh 12,000, of the tribe of Simeon 12,000, of the tribe of Levi 12,000, of the tribe of Issachar 12,000, of the tribe of Zebulun 12,000, of the tribe of Joseph 12,000, of the tribe of Benjamin were sealed 12,000. Notice that this is the same language as we find in the book of Numbers chapter 1, where we list the head of the tribe, which is not listed here in Revelation 7, but we do read about how many were in that tribe. Here in Revelation 7, the number of each tribe just happens to be 12,000. Now, that is nowhere near the number that was counted in Israel's first census. The one whose army never fought. They didn't go into the promised land and they never fought a war. The 144,000 is far less in number than the second army that was counted in Numbers 26. Yet, given that this army, the 144,000, will face a huge global army, not just tiny city-states within Israel's border, it might be expected that this end times army of Yahweh needs to be much bigger, exponentially bigger. Wherein lies the exponential abilities of this small army? Well, its exponential nature comes from its relationship with the host of the army, Yeshua. Not each man's age, physical ability or bulk or size, martial arts training or formal military training. These are the warriors that each one will put a thousand to flight, and two working together will put 10,000 to flight. The ability of each warrior of the 144,000 will far exceed the abilities of the 603,550 of the original army, and the abilities of the second army of 601,730. What the 144,000 will accomplish exponentially will be based on their level of loyalty to Yeshua and their obedience to his law. We know that these men will go to war with Yeshua because an enemy makes war with the Lamb in Revelation 17:14, and these men go wherever the Lamb goes in Revelation 14:4, and in Revelation 14:1, they're standing on the Mount of Olives, mustered for war with Yeshua as their head. Therefore, they are with the Lamb of God, Yeshua, for the war in Revelation 17. And they are able to defeat all of Yahweh's enemies because this enemy will have the ability to, in Leviticus 26, verses 7 and 8, chase your enemies and they will fall before you by the sword. Five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. So these 144,000, whose abilities I believe will be greatly underestimated by the enemy, will defeat 2,880,000 enemy warriors if you have five of these men each chasing 100 warriors. And they could put 14,400,000 enemy warriors to flight if 100 of them working together chase 10,000 enemies. So how is this possible? How will the 144 accomplish this? Or the 144,000? How will they accomplish this? Well, they will do it by walking in Yahweh's statutes and keeping his commandments as promised in Leviticus 26, verse 3, where he says, before Leviticus 26, verses 7 and 8, if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, you're going to chase your enemies. Thus, their physical abilities, bulk, size, age, martial arts training, former military training, have nothing to do with their exploits. Those men who think they need to be in some kind of martial arts or military pursuits are missing the point. It's about whether you walk in Yahweh's statutes and keep his commandments. So now back to Bamidbar, where the legal documented establishment of each tribe's military contribution is established. One tribe in Numbers 1:47 and 2:33 that is not listed among those warriors is Levi. Levi is not among the warriors here, but he is among the warriors in Revelation 7. Missing in Revelation 7 is Dan and Ephraim. There is something in the character of the 144,000 tribal leaders that we need to know about, something that sets them apart and qualifies them to go into battle for Israel. What is it? Well, let's look at the requirements for being a leader in Israel. Exodus 18:21. Moreover, you shall provide out of all the people able men which fear God, men of truth, hating unjust gain, and place such over the people to be rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. And in verse 25, Moses chose able men out of all Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. The qualifications to be a leader in Israel, and I will submit to be a first fruit in Israel, is for the men to love truth and hate injustice. These end-time leaders going into battle will have these qualifications, but they will have one additional qualification. They will be those who are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are those who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. So that's two qualifications, actually. These were redeemed by Yeshua from among men, the first fruits to God and to the Lamb. That's Revelation 14:4. Now, let's talk about their virginity for a moment. This plays into why the tribes of Ephraim and Dan are not included in the list of the 144,000. What does it mean that these men, these leaders, are virgins? Well, they are not virgins in the sense that we think of that today. The Greek word for virgin is parthenos, and it has four correlate Hebrew words, betula, alma, nara, and nar. Three of these define young women as different stages of virgins or being maidens. You know, being young and in their father's house, being betrothed, and so forth. But these are men and warriors, age 20 or older. Remember, the Torah says all warriors must be at least 20. So Betula, Alma, and Na'ra define the innocence of young women, especially in the sexual sense. But Betula, Alma, and Na'ra do not fit the description of grown men. There is, however, another Hebrew correlate word that does fit, Na'ar. It's Strong's 5288, and it means a boy from the age of infancy to adolescence, but it has another meaning, servant. These men, age 20, are not adolescents, but they have the same innocence as boys. This word, na'ar, meaning servant, describes who these men are. They are faithful servants of God and the King of Israel. In fact, they are so faithful to him that he is more to them than God and King. He is their lamb, and they follow him wherever he goes. Now, this does not mean these men are not married and that they don't have families. None of Israel's warriors were commanded to not marry. But it is a requirement for all Israelites to remain faithful in spirit and in flesh. In spirit, it is spirit, the spirit of faithfulness to only Yahweh, and in flesh, it is the spirit of faithfulness to wife. It means that they have never left the faith in Yeshua to be defiled with sexual perversions or relationships with heathen men, like the men in the first Exodus that were defiled with the Moabite and Midianite women and who worshipped those women's gods. And these 144,000 are not adulterers. They are described also as being without guile. Revelation 14:5 says, "In their mouth was found no lie, for they are blameless." Well, let's compare what Yeshua said of Nathanael. In John 1:47, Yeshua saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile." The Greek word dolos, Strong's G1388, is used in both verses, there in Revelation 14:5 and in John 1:47, and it is used to for the English words lie and guile. So what is guile? Well, that's another word for being deceitful, cunning, and a liar. There is no deceit, no lying among the men of the 144,000. They don't need that. They don't need to try to trick their enemy. They just are going to set them leaving. They're going to chase the enemy, and the enemy is going to leave. Not because they tricked him in any way. Sexual perversion and deceitfulness are clues as to why Ephraim and Dan are missing from the list of the 144,000. How did Dan and Ephraim become weak? Well, both Ephraim and Dan were tribes that led the northern house of Israel into idolatry, and with idolatry comes fornication. Sex with whatever temple prostitute is available, and even being male prostitute. King Jeroboam of the tribe of Ephraim led all of the northern tribes into a repeat of worshiping a golden calf, which quickly turned into Baal and Asherah worship after the kingdom of David was split by the conflict with Rehoboam, Solomon's son. The northern house of Israel never once turned back from its rebellion. Never once. Jeroboam also set up another calf. He set up the first calf in Bethel, in the Ephraimite territory, and then he set up another one in Dan's territory. The tribe of Dan was described as idolatrous long before this ever happened in Judges 18. So setting up a golden calf there was easy to do. It was before these golden calves which the Israelites rose up to play, a euphemism for public sex to Baal and Asherah. This is what the 144,000 are known to not have ever done. As if the image worship of the golden calf and the idolatrous worship of Baal and Asherah were not enough, Ephraim and Dan also showed themselves to be weak in battle. Ephraim turned back in a battle, according to the psalmist Asaph in Psalm 78:9, and Dan showed himself incapable of capturing and keeping his rightful territory that was given to him by Joshua. Judges 1:34 says, "The Amorites forced the children of Dan into the hill country, for they will not allow them to come down into the valley." So the Amorites were keeping the children of Dan hidden up in the hill country. Dan's territory abutted the Philistines, and it is from this geographical situation that we have the account of Samson, the Danite judge, whose character was typical of the tribe of Dan, and especially his wicked relationship with Delilah. As the Philistines were making frequent incursions into Dan's territory, Delilah was making her incursion into Samson's life. Dan was unable to hold the territory allotted to him, and they kept losing territory to the Philistines to the point where, according to Judges 18, a small group of Danites moved north next to Naphtali's territory, where they defeated the Sidonian city of Laish, and they lived there. And it was there that Jeroboam set up the second golden calf. So because of the image worship, idolatry, the weakness in battle, neither tribe will get the honor of serving in the most important wars Israel will ever fight. Ephraim and Dan are the epitome of rebellion and lust. Whereas the men included in the 144,000 are just the opposite. They are brave. There's no guile or trickery in them. They follow their only God and King, knowing Him intimately as the Lamb, and they have no weaknesses. The 144,000 cannot afford to have weak links. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So no Ephraim and no Dan. Furthermore, the 144,000 worship their God, King, Lamb, and Commander like no one else. Revelation 14, 2 and 3. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps, and they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. They serve the Lamb as singing priests and warriors. Now, the 144,000 are only men. Sorry, ladies. They are king priests and warriors, two Israelite occupations not permitted for women. Women, though, will be part of those men's families. How do I know this? I know because Yahweh does nothing new. Everything He will do at the end will be what He did in the beginning. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no one else. I am God and there is none like me. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. Yahweh will not do something new at the end of days. Why? Because He wants His people to understand what He is doing and to know what is happening and to be able to recognize the enemy. He lets us know if we can look at the principles and the patterns that He gave us from the beginning, we will know what's going on. And one of the major failures in prophecy interpretation today is this failure of modern prophets to look at what Yahweh did before. So with that in mind, let's look at Israel in the very beginning, in the first 2 years of its existence, and particularly in the book of Numbers, when Yahweh mustered His new Israelite army in the first month of the second year, or the 13th month, as it were. So we have seen that Israel's first army was comprised of 603,550 warriors. Was this the total population of Israel at that time? No. Most of those men were likely married and had children. Some may have been single. It was not required of Israelite warriors in the beginning to be single. And it may come as a surprise to you that men in ancient Israel were required to be chaste like women. We don't have time to go back and look at the scriptures for that today, but you can read the passages about what happens when there's unmarried sex between an unmarried man and an unmarried woman, or between married men and married women, and what happens to them. Two virgin youths, a male Na'ar and a female Na'ara, both virgins, suffer penalties when this happens. Now, I spoke earlier of the chastity of the 144,000 using the word Na'ar, and we now understand that an unmarried man must wait until marriage to have sex. Let me ask you if you believe that married men and women are no longer chaste. You know, if you've gotten married, now you're having sex, that means you're no longer chaste. It means that you're no longer in that category of people who have been sexually clean. I submit to you that, yes, men and women who are married to each other and they've only had each other, as long as they remain faithful to each other, are in this category as sexually clean. When Revelation 14:4 says that these men are not defiled with women, there are two meanings. The first is that they are chaste, whether they're single or married. The second is that they have never engaged in fornication, worshiping another god through sex with a prostitute or a whore. They have not engaged in pornography, the satanic worship of women and men and through sexual images, which really is, porneo is where we get pornography, and that's fornication. That really is worshiping Satan through those images. This is one of the reasons Yahweh built the hedge around images with the command to not make, acquire, or use them. These warriors are faithful to God, their parents. They did not dishonor their parents by having sex before marriage. And they honor their wives. They have not gone outside their marriage for sex. With that in mind, and returning to my previous question, were these warriors the total population of Israel or not? Well, we can now see that Israel is much more than warriors. The 144,000 number is given to us to show the perfection of Israel that comes at the end of days through the number itself. And their appearance on the world stage is a great big announcement to everyone that Israel is now fully restored and will now take its rightful place as the head of all the nations. And behind most, if not all, of those men will be families supporting them. The young men under the age of 20 and the older men who are too old to fight, their own wives and children, along with everyone else who Yeshua is now saving, are represented by these men, just as in the beginning in the book of Numbers chapters 1 and 2. Just as the population of the first Israel was estimated to be at least four times more than the 603,550,000, which makes it close to 3 million people, those 144,000 will represent an even greater number of restored Israelites. How do I know that? Revelation 7, 9, and 10. After this, I beheld, and lo, a great multitude which no man could number of all nations, kindreds, people, and tongues stood before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes and palms in their hand, crying with a loud voice, "Salvation to our God, which sits upon the throne, and to the Lamb." Right here is where all Israel gets saved. We read about that in Romans 11:26. And right here is where Israel gets fully restored, when we have the 144,000 and we see the multitude that they represent. No more religious people acting like Yeshua did not already accomplish this on the cross. The wickedness of those who for the last 2,000 years have refused to acknowledge Israel's full restoration will now come to an end. 144,000 are the first fruits in Revelation 14:4, but there's always a great big crop of fruits that follow the first fruits. You bring your first fruits as tithe to Yahweh at his temple. But there's always more fruit for Israel. You see, so Israel is more than the 144,000. Now, let's talk about some terminology. In Christianity and all over the internet via various definitions of the word bride, we get different definitions. The scripture tells us that Yeshua's bride is 1, his city, and 2, his people. A bride in scripture is the Betula, and she's the one who is betrothed but not yet married. Israel's people, Israel, are referred to wife. He's referring to them as wife in the Tanakh. This wife is the one who was married to Yahweh at Mount Sinai. She came out of Egypt as a betrothed, and then at Mount Sinai he married her. Paul talked about this, explaining how Yeshua can now take another bride to himself. You see, he had a wife. She was unfaithful, so he divorced her. But then he had a great big problem because he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that their descendants would always be complete. And with Jacob, that turns out to be 12 tribes. But now with the northern tribes, whether you count them as 9 or 10, and they're divorced, and Yahweh said they can't come back, in the book of Hosea, now Yahweh has a problem because the Torah says he cannot remarry a woman that he divorced. And who did he divorce? The northern house of Israel. Well, now he has to die in order to completely sever the tie of marriage for both the northern and southern houses of Israel, the Ephraimites and the Jews. Since his resurrection 2,000 years ago, he has been adding individuals to his kingdom, one at a time, instead of that one big group of people that he brought out of Egypt the first time. This new group over the last 2,000 years, this grouping of individuals is Yeshua's bride. We're betrothed to him. Once he returns, and at Sukkot in some future year will be the wedding of that bride when she will become his wife. From this wife, who is 12 tribed Israel restored, will come more kings, vassal kings, priests, warriors, regular citizens with no special jobs that I know of right now, except to be citizens who do the job of glorifying their king. Yeshua will rule over the nations, Psalms 2:7-8, and Israel will rule with him, 2 Timothy 2:12 and Revelation 20:4. The point of it, this is that the 144 is not the entirety of Israel or the bride, the betrothed, as people like the Jehovah's Witnesses say. The 12 tribes restored are the bride of Israel awaiting their marriage. We are now betrothed, we're the bride, and Jerusalem is also his bride. And we will be married, and by the way, we're going to be married at Jerusalem, in Jerusalem at some future Sukkot, at the wedding feast of the bride. That's part of what Sukkot is about. And we will become Yeshua's wife. We will stop being bride. We will become his wife. The other point to understand is that the character of the 144,000 has to do with their understanding that obedience to the commandments is paramount. They understand that the law is our righteousness, according to Deuteronomy 4:8. It is our right standing before Yahweh as the expression of our faith in Yeshua's salvation. Salvation comes from Yeshua. Our continuing in our walk, our faith, is in the law. Now, I'm going to leave that. I gave you a lot to chew on. Let's move on to the rest of the Torah portion, which explains more about the major change in the law that the book of Hebrews talks about. We're going to talk about Aaron and the Levites, and this will be quick. We've had a habit. We get sloppy in Christianity, Judaism, in Hebrew roots, Messianic Judaism. We get very sloppy, referring to the line of Aaron as, quote-unquote, the Levites. We also refer to, quote-unquote, the Levites as the Levites. This is confusing. All of Aaron's line are Levites, but not all Levites are of Aaron's line. And we're seeing in this Torah portion that the line of Aaron is elevated above all three lines which came from Levi. Levi's sons were Kohath, Gershom, and Merari. Aaron comes from the Kohath line, but the Kohath line has a separate job of its own. The firstborns of Israel had been chosen to be dedicated for the tabernacle service that is now being given to the three lines of Levites in Numbers 3 and 4. Three times in chapter 3, Yahweh makes it clear why the Levites are being pressed into service. Numbers 3, 12, verse 41, and verse 45. And I do mean they're pressed into service. The Levites were not given a choice in this matter. Notice that the Levites also do not receive a perpetual promise of working in the temple, such as Aaron received for his lineage. This is because the Melchizedek firstborn priesthood will be coming back. The line of Aaron will continue to do the sacrifices forever, but the firstborns of Melchizedek will serve in the temple as the Levites did in the past, doing the jobs of the Kohathites, Gershonites, and Merarites. Let me reiterate that had the firstborns not failed at the golden calf, this scripture would say Yahweh was presenting the firstborns of Israel to Aaron instead of the Levites. This is a major change in the law written about in the book of Hebrews because of the treason of the golden calf. One way we know this is from Numbers 30, verse 40, which says, Yahweh said to Moses, number all the firstborn of the males of the sons of Israel from a month old and upward, and take the number of their names. So Yahweh is about to redeem the firstborns, pay their way out of their inherited duties toward him. That's what he's going to do. The Levites now have this service from a month old, But the firstborns have to be counted the same way that the Levites were counted. They have to give one Levite for a firstborn from a month old and upward, so that the redemption count would be complete and equal. But now we read in Numbers 3, verse 15, count the children of Levi by their fathers' houses, by their families, count every male from a month old and upward. So the service of the Levites is not like the service of warriors. Levitical service is lifelong and begins when the male baby is 1 month old. Warrior service begins at age 20 and lasts the lifetime or until the man is no longer physically able to fight. From their infancy, Levites were a highly trained corps whose first job was the protection of the line of Aaron in the center of the camp and secondarily the care and carrying of the tabernacle. Even though these are listed in reverse in this Torah portion and in Naso. Numbers 3:88 says, those who encamp before the tabernacle eastward in front of the tent of meeting toward the sunrise shall be Moses and Aaron and his sons, keeping the requirements of the sanctuary for the duty of the children of Israel. The stranger who comes near shall be put to death. Aaron and his sons and Moses were in the center of the camp facing east. The Levites were given the duty of guarding Israel's administration and its administrators, if I can use this modern terminology. A stranger here is not just a non-Israelite. It is one who does not belong near to the tabernacle unless coming to sacrifice. As one approaches the tabernacle or temple, the holiness goes higher. Only certain people are allowed into the higher levels of the holiness, the Kedusha. All others to those areas are strangers, whether one is an Israelite or not. Numbers 3:45 says, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the children of Israel and the livestock of the Levites instead of their livestock, and the Levites shall be mine. Before, Yahweh was saying, the firstborn are mine. Now he's saying the Levites are mine. So not only did the firstborns lose their rightful place to serve Yahweh, but even their cattle are no longer in service to Yahweh. Now, Yahweh has let the firstborns be redeemed from their automatic conscription service, but there is a problem. The redemption was one Levite for one firstborn. There are now too many firstborns. Because of wickedness, the number of men able to carry the workload is reduced. And by the way, we see this principle of reduction in what I shared earlier about the number of warriors in the beginning of the book of Numbers and how that number will decline toward the end when there's another census in the book of Numbers. So the counting resulted in 273 more firstborns than there were Levites. Numbers 3:43 tells us this. How many were the Levites? 22,000. How many were the firstborns according to Numbers 3:43? 22,273. In verses 44 and 45, Yahweh spoke to Moses saying, take the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the sons of Israel, and the cattle of the Levites instead of the cattle of the firstborn, and the Levites shall be mine. So this is how Yahweh substituted the Levites for the firstborns. He took the Levites and the Levites' cattle, putting them into service, removing the firstborns, rather, and the firstborn's cattle from service. This was one Levite for a firstborn with 273 firstborns left over. That's why you need the money redemption. 5 shekels per every firstborn, according to Numbers 3, 46 and 47. In Exodus 30, verses 13 to 15, every Israelite is worth half a shekel. But the firstborns were worth 5 shekels. This indicates the enormous value and place that they lost in Israel at that time. Numbers 3:51 says Moses gave the redemption money to Aaron and to his sons. So the line of Aaron literally sold, as it were, the firstborns out of service. They got the money for it. They sold them out. Now they have the money from that. Firstborns are now out of the picture. Yahweh took the firstborns and made them regular citizens with no special standing in Israel because of their sin at the golden calf. And he gave to Aaron all of the Levites that stood with Moses, plus 5 shekels each for the overage of 273 firstborns. Now the Levites belong to Aaron instead of the firstborns. And this is why I keep saying the firstborns would have served the line of Aaron doing the jobs that the Levites now are going to do. I want to clarify what I said earlier about the Levites being pressed into service and make it clear that this conscription or this draft, if you will, was not without honor. There were rewards for the Levites. Numbers 4, verse 2 says, take the sum of the house, the sons of Kohath from the sons of Levi, from 30 years old and upward to 50 years, all that enter into service to do the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. So here's another difference between the line of Levi and that are doing the service in the temple and the warriors. The Levitical service ends at the age of 50. Active duty ends at the age of 50. Begins when they're a month old, ends at 50. But from temple records, we know that the Levites, even those from the line of Aaron, began training for their jobs at the age of 20. That's the same age when warriors became liable for going to war. At the age of 50, they stopped serving the administration, but they took on the jobs after 50 of being teachers. So the lines of Aaron and the Levites trained from 20 to 30 years old. At 30 years old to 50, they served and then they became teachers. The line of Kohath was set apart to handle the most sacred objects in the tabernacle, but they were in danger of dying over it, which is why Yahweh said, you guys, Aaron, you go in there and you cover all those things up, lest those men from Kohath should die. So Aaron and his sons were appointed to cover the most holy things so the Kohathites would not die in service. Now, from here, at verse 20, the rabbis have broken up this Torah portion. The next portion starts with the duties of Gershom and Merari in the Naso Torah portion. Well, that does not make sense to me. We have read the full chapter 4 through to verse 49, which makes more sense to finish up talking about the duties of Gershom and Merari. And then Naso has a clean start with an entirely different topic. So the Gershonites and the Merarites were also counted from the age of 30 250. They were counted the same way. Gershonites carried the curtains and the skins over the tents and the hangings, the door of the entry to the gates. Merari carried all the hardware, the boards, bars, pillars, sockets, the ropes, the cords, you know, that tied everything down, all of those accessories and the vessels that pertain to that. At verse 34, we read about the details of the counting of the Kohathites, Gershonites, and Merarites from the ages of 30 to 50. And again, this is a legal language. No one can usurp their jobs. The setting up of the army, that's legal language. In the end of days, the setting up of the 144,000, that's legal language. Now, when we get into the kingdom, Joseph and Dan, Ephraim is Joseph's son, they have their own gates going into the temple according to Ezekiel. But now we have now all the legalities of what Kohath, Gershon, and Merari are to do. One last thing. Have you ever wondered why the Jews are such good historians? Well, it isn't necessarily because Judah, Benjamin, and Simeon are so good at keeping records. Rather, it is because the line of Aaron was so good at it. Had they not been careful about who served, men could have died. And the records, the recordings, served to prevent fights over rights and jobs in the tabernacle. The Levites have always done a pretty good job most of the time. It wasn't until they got to Babylon that their record-keeping began to fail. They were leading Israel into idolatry even before the Babylonian exile, but they were still keeping good records. However, during all of their stay in Babylon, they began to fail in keeping records to the point where some of the descendants that came back to Jerusalem could not be properly identified as being part of the Aaronic priesthood. Looking back on Israel's history, we can see our ancestors' utter failures. Looking forward to what is yet to come, we can see Israel's bright future and utter success. The 144,000, the bride of Messiah, who has the testimony of Yeshua and keeps his commandments, that's what defines all of Israel. That mysterious, quote-unquote, woman who flees to the wilderness where the first generation failed, but where this woman will succeed, shows us Yahweh's grand plan. And we, hallelujah, could live to see it happen. Amen. And that concludes this teaching.